today doing some, starting with the introduction to the suttas, just as yesterday we started looking at the Vinaya, and the suttas of course being the other great part of Buddhist literature. Usually we divide, the most basic division of Buddhist teaching or Buddhist dispensation is into the Dhamma and Vinaya, and so the suttas being the Dhamma part of things. Now, just like yesterday, I started out by asking what is sutta, so now I'll ask everybody what is Dhamma. I asked what is Vinaya, yeah, and now what is Dhamma?
Truth
Truth, law of nature? Law of nature? Chandra?
Nature.
Okay. Penny, what was yours again? Teaching. Free distribution books. Distribution. Oops. Distribution. That's actually a very postmodern suggestion there, Roy. Because Roy there has gone beyond the seeking for an abstract and timeless presentation of Dhamma to choosing one which is very embedded in its social and material context. And that's it's very true that for many people Dhamma is what they read in the free distribution books. Yeah, they get this book and it says I'm a Dhamma book, so you get it and then you read it, and that's the way you access the Buddhism. And what somebody has chosen to put in one of those books and distribute it and call Buddhism, that defines the choice of what many people have access to in terms of the Dhamma. For example, when I was in Adelaide a few years ago, they wanted me to teach a sutta class, and I said to the people in the group, I said, okay, look, have you got any books with suttas in or something like that? I didn't have any materials with me. And so they sort of hunted around and they came up with a free distribution copy of the Mahasatipatthana Sutta. And said, okay, we couldn't do this. So he said, okay. And then I just started out by just reflecting on that. The reason why we have this particular sutta is because somebody printed it. Yeah, somebody paid money and to get this printed, and it's been distributed, and that's why we have access to this particular sutta, not one of the other thousands of suttas that we could be reading. So that's very good. That's my favourite. Okay, so there's some different understandings of Dhamma. And Dhamma, we looked at Dhamma, usually there's a few different renderings you could use for it. One is a principle, which is like a natural law or something. Another is phenomena. Phenomena meaning something which appears. Yeah? A phenomenon appears to you. It's the basic meaning of it, root meaning of it. These are translation, and then truth or teaching is the expression of that. and also law, but that's similar to principle or law. Okay, can we call it Dhamma? Rule? No, it's also Dhamma. Okay. So the idea, once you've noticed that it goes from principle to law to rule, then it's not dissimilar to actually the vinaya. There's the vinaya and there's lots of rules in the vinaya. And actually in the vinaya, each rule is called a dhamma. Just to keep things confusing. Right? So the conceptual distinction between these two things is not at all hard and fast. So now when we're going to be teaching this series of classes, we're going to be using as our basic text this thing, In the Buddha's Words. Okay? An anthology of discourses from the Pali Canon, edited and introduced by Bhikkhu Bodhi. Alright? So the reason for choosing this book is because, of course, anything by Bhikkhu Bodhi is good. That's the number one reason. Second reason is because it gives, in a reasonably compact form, a good summary and survey of the main teachings. And I know some of you have read it, some of you maybe haven't, but in any case we get to review a lot of the major teachings and get a good overview of them. Alrighty. Now, of course, having just mentioned, thanks to Roy, the importance of understanding the material context and background of a particular teaching or something, then I think it's good to just, before we start plunging into the texts themselves, to just give a little bit of thought to where do these things come from? What's the background to them? What's the history? And so on and so forth. And what are they? How can anybody come along and claim to say, in the Buddha's words? Isn't that terribly conceited? Here I am, I'm putting out a book, I'm saying, in the Buddha's words. And the Buddha presumably lived 2,500 years ago. How on earth do we know what his words were? Right? And so I think it's very, very important that we have a realistic understanding of what actually we mean by saying it's in the Buddha's words. We've all come here, we're all going to devote our lives to following the path of Buddhism. Yeah? Now we could be mistaken, right? We could have got it all wrong. Maybe it's not the Buddha's words actually, maybe it's Mara's words. Yeah? And so it's important that we have some idea. What is the background to it? What reason do we have for thinking this is the Buddha's words? Now, of course, the as they say, the proof of the pudding is in the eating, right? So the real way to test it is to practice it, yeah, and to try following it, try putting the teachings into practice and so on, and then we can see. But nevertheless, we still need a reason to do that in the first place, and we also need some guide to questions of, some teachings are not easy to put into practice. Sometimes we might take many years of diligent practice before we can realise certain things. Yeah? So we need, why do we have the faith to continue that? So I just want to talk a little bit first about this question, and what do we mean when we say something's in the Buddha's words? So if we cast our mind back to ancient India and to the time of the Buddha, just try to imagine what it would have been like. By our standards, we're thinking of a very simple society. No technology like this, laptops and things like that. We're talking about a vast land of jungle, Indian region. The Ganges Valley at that time was mostly jungles. The Himalayas coming up to the north, the river Ganges coming down through the middle of the land, very dominated by this river, and here's the Ganges, Himalaya up to the north. And the whole region around here, being where the Buddha was born and lived and so on, mostly being jungle, a few modest-sized cities. There weren't, in the Buddha's day, there weren't vast metropolises. There were, you know, medium-sized cities. I mean, I guess, who's to say how big the cities were? Maybe a few hundred thousand people in the biggest cities, something like that, just as a guess. So you'd wander for a long time through the jungles, down sort of obscure jungle tracks with tigers around the place. The Buddha speaks often of lions, so there were lions in India at that time, even though, of course, today there haven't been lions for a long time, but there were lions there, tigers, elephants, all of these kinds of things. The power of nature and the power of the jungle was not tamed as it is for us. Yeah? For us, the bush is something, or the jungle is something we can go to as a tourist. We can feel confident that we've vanquished the bush, we've vanquished the jungle. But this is a very modern development, yeah? And it's important to reflect that it's not like that at all. I was just reading recently about the history of teddy bears. And we don't think about the history of teddy bears as much as we should do, but they're important to me because I usually use a teddy bear on my meditation retreats. But a teddy bear was only invented 100 years ago. Yeah? And if you look, even not much before that, 150, 200 years ago, the bear was always a symbol of always used something that's very primitive, very dangerous, very, very coarse and crude, yeah? And which was very threatening. Yeah? And it's only in the last 100 years or so that we felt that we conquered nature enough that we can turn it into a little cuddly bear that we can give to our children. Huh?
The bear is a symbol of money.
Is it? So in India at the time there wasn't a large empire which dominated the whole of India, but there would be smaller regional republics or kingdoms which would dominate particular areas. And of course there was always being contested about the boundaries and these kinds of things. The Buddha was born in the Shakyan Republic, which was up here, a fairly small republic, capital of Kapilavastu, where the Buddha was brought up. You see the Kapilavastu is right now on the present-day border between Nepal and India. The Shakyan Republic was then under the rulership of Kosala, which is a larger kingdom here. And Kosala was ruled at the time of the Buddha by King Pasenadi. Capital of Kosala, of course, was Savatthi, which is curiously enough not named on this map, but Savatthi was up about here. The other major kingdom in the Buddha's day was the Magadhan kingdom, which was down here, and this is where the Buddha was enlightened and where he spent much of his time. Most of the suttas are situated in Savatthi and Kosala, or else in the Magadha region. It's kind of in between those. We have Kasi here, also known as Benares, and actually that was being fought over in that time between Magadha and Kosala, were fighting over Kasi. Another one is important, which is not mentioned on this map, is the Vajin Republic, and that was just north of the Ganges here. Okay. So there's... There were two main systems of political systems. One was a monarchy, the other was like an aristocratic republic where the rulership would be shared among the leaders of the ruling clans in a country. And so the Shakyan was a republic and the Vajjayans was also a republic. So like a quasi-democratic system. but without, not everybody could vote, but only the, it'd be like if the landowners could vote, kind of a bit like a feudal system or something. Okay. So that's the political situation in the time of the Buddha. So, of course, the Buddha, born in Lumbini, grew up in Kapilavastu, went forth at the age of 29, spent 6 years practicing meditation and trying various teachings and so on in the jungles and forests, mainly in the Magadhan region, before attaining enlightenment at the age of 35 at Gaya. And from that time, he spent his time wandering around India and staying in various monasteries and so on. So his teaching, which he gave, was an oral teaching. Okay? He didn't write anything down. And in that way, he's in common with actually most of the great founders of religions didn't actually write anything down themselves, like Socrates, Pythagoras, Jesus, Muhammad. And his followers, his students, would memorize his teachings as they were given. Now, this is something which seems to us to be quite extraordinary. Yeah? We find it very difficult to imagine how you can actually memorize things just from hearing at one time. And we wonder how that's possible. But actually, it is quite possible. And it's something which, having a kind of a faith or an understanding of the oral tradition has never been particularly a problem for me. And I think the reason being because I used to be a musician. And when you've studied music and played songs for many, many years, it becomes second nature to you. And it's actually quite easy to listen to a song just once and then be able to remember it. Yeah, maybe you can't get all the words, but maybe after two or three times, then you can remember it all completely. Or even just being able to, if you're familiar with the forms and the structures, then that enables you to pick it up. You can even play a song even without having heard it. Okay? So somebody can say, okay, let's do this. We start playing, and then you just join in. You haven't even heard the song once, and you can still play along because you're familiar with the structures that songs tend to be built in. And so when we look at the Buddhist suttas, right the way through, they are built with a tremendous attention to the mnemonic devices of oral literature. And the most obvious one of these, which we encounter again and again and again, which is perhaps the dominating feature of Buddhist literature, is repetition. Okay, we find it constantly, the suttas repeating themselves, same phrases occurring again and again and again. And the repetitions happen at many different levels. Big chunks of text get repeated, small lines get repeated inside the text, words and phrases get repeated, and all kinds of literary tricks like that. And all of those things are often seen from a reading point of view as being a bit of a distraction, a bit of a waste of time. You know, it's a bit tedious to sort of wade your way through each repetition of everything. So that's from our perspective as a reader. But from an oral tradition, those are the things that enable you to memorize something. And when you memorize it, you get the overall structure, and you can learn to fill in the details. And the basic structure of most Buddhist suttas, or many suttas, is in fact exactly the same as the structure of the 6:30 news. I don't know if anybody's noticed that. When you watch the news on telly, they start out by saying, well, here's the headlines, blah, 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 blah. And then they tell the stories, which basically repeats the headlines with a few explanations. And then at the end of it, they say, and just we'll repeat the headlines again. And so they say, we'll repeat the headlines. That's how they do the news. Yeah? So you have the summary, exposition, and then the summary again. And that's exactly how so many suttas are. Okay, monks, I'm going to teach the four Satipatthanas. What for? And he explains them. And then he says, these monks are the four Satipatthanas. So it's exactly the same format. So when the Buddha was teaching, the monks and nuns would listen, they would remember the teachings, they would go away, recite them, And so this process is described in some of the suttas where it talks about this. It talks about paying close attention while listening to the Dhamma, hearing the joy and the interest that arises in the mind from the chance to listen to the Dhamma, and then memorizing those teachings, reflecting on them and reciting them afterwards. So it's not just a passive process of just sitting there and listening, but to recite them afterwards, to scrutinize the meaning of the Dhamma in the mind. And this process is talked about in quite a few suttas. So in each little place the Buddha would give these teachings, he would be responding to questions, he would be debating with members of various different religious communities, agreeing with some things, disagreeing with other things. he spoke with people from all walks of life, the wealthiest, the kings and so on, as well as the lepers and the beggars and so on. And of course it attracted a large community of followers and bhikkhus and bhikkhunis. Now as the Buddha was going around teaching from place to place, again, just to imagine that situation, you know, imagine here we are staying in a monastery practicing, Buddha walks down the driveway, right? What do we say? Well, the first thing we say is, look, I'm sorry, visiting hours are shut. You have to come back tomorrow. This happened in one of the suttas. The Buddha was shooed away by the monastery keeper. The monk said, no, not him. It doesn't count for him. He's the Buddha. So then he comes in and he sits down with the community, you know, just like we have when we have the visiting monks that come or visiting nuns that come. We sit down, we discuss things, ask questions, yeah, and then goes away. Now you can imagine that in each monastery that he would visit, that people would get slightly different teachings. Yeah, so he would come to one place, then he'd see here, oh well, look, here the monks are really, really haven't got it together. You know, they're really kind of messy, they're really dirty. You know, they've got that. So I have to give them teachings on how to look after a monastery. You know, and look, guys, this is how to clean the toilets, right? And so he'd give teachings on that. He'd go to another monastery down the road. All the bhikkhunis are there sitting perfectly still in jhanas, meditating all night, and so on. He says, wow, these guys have really got it together. So he'd give them a very profound teaching about dependent origination, the nature of emptiness, yeah? So different places, they would have different teachings and remember them in different ways. And so, of course, then that would give rise to debate among the community. Then one person would go from one to the other and would say, you know, the Buddha was the greatest teacher of toilet cleaning ever. Huh? And the people in the other monastery would say, well, I don't know if toilet cleaning was a big thing. I was just reading in one... toilet cleaning, yes. No, actually, it was just... just as an example of this, where were we... anyway, I just found a teacher, the Buddhist Sutra on Healing Hemorrhoids. There's one I just came across by accident when I was just doing this. I hadn't heard of that one before. So anyway, so people obviously had different perceptions of what the Buddha's teaching was. So there was a need to then standardize things. Okay, so this is the process of canonizing. And in that process of canonizing, obviously, is quite a fraught process because you have to say, well, these things are important, these things are not important. You have to how do you organize it? So the decisions that are made by the people controlling that process will then influence the shape and the form that the suttas are passed down from that point onwards. Okay? Now that process must have started during the Buddha's life. Okay? So there were already in the Buddha's life accepted texts. Buddha himself refers to some of these in his own scriptures. So for example, one time the lay people come to him and they said, you know, what should we practice? And he said, oh, you should learn the Brahmajala Sutta. Okay, you should study the 62 views of the Brahmajala Sutta. And the lay people are like, come on, give us a break. We haven't got time to learn the 62 views of the Brahmajala Sutta. Give us something easier. So it was an accepted discourse which was current in the community. Or on another occasion, the Buddha was visited by a monk Sona from the south region, and this was from down in Ujjaini, Yuvanti region. This is the furthest that Buddhism reached in the time of the Buddha. And he came to see the Buddha up in Magadha, or probably in Sarvati, and stayed with the Buddha in his kuti. And the Buddha asked him to teach some, to recite some verses. And so he recited the verses of the Attakatha, which are now in the Sutta Nipata. So again, there was accepted texts which were passed down and accepted as canonical during the time of the Buddha's own life. Now, so, Eki-chan? Parinibbaka and
the sages
came
from Kanchi, and then did they return to Kanchi?
Kanchi, is that in the Parinibbaka?
Yeah, they came there.
Godavari, yeah. I remember Godavari being one thing mentioned. Let's see, Pratisthana is another name that's mentioned in the Parinibbaka. Kanchi, I can't remember Kanchi, but maybe. There was a number of names it mentioned, and actually mentioned all of the places along the journey that they took. Which is that route is known as the Dakshinapatha, the southern route. This in here is some mountains and things, so it's not so convenient for travel. So they tend to go up here, along the rivers, and down to Andhra. So that's the furthest most reach that we get in the south in the time of the Buddha. Yeah, down to this region. But generally, the furthest that Buddhism reached was Ujjaini and Avanti, and that's kind of the next stage here, then to Andhra, and then of course to Sri Lanka in the time of King Ashoka. Similarly, in the north, generally speaking, reached up to Kosala and then up to Kuru, where the Saripatthana Sutta and others were taught. Kurukshetra, up here, is of course the legendary location of the great battle of the Mahabharata. And so this was furthest to the west and the north. This is what they call the northern road, the Uttarapatha. And of course, after, by the time of King Ashoka, Buddhism was well established up in Gandhara, in Kashmir. So this is the northern route, Uttarapatha. This is the southern route, Dakshinapatha. So in the standardizing of the Buddhist texts, in the Buddha's life, what we get as a set of classifications for the Buddha's teachings, we don't hear about the Nikayas, we don't hear about the Tripitaka, none of these things are mentioned in the suttas themselves, okay? But what we do get is a list that we call the nine Angas. Okay, either 9 or 12 in some groups, in some texts. But the early group is probably the 9. And here are the 9 Angas. And I wrote about these in the first part of History of Mindfulness. So here, this one, Sutra. The first one. So notice here that sutra doesn't mean all what we call today sutras. Okay, it's just one class, one out of 9 classes of text is called sutra here. It's not everything. It has here prose discourse. I don't think that's precise enough, because a lot of these are prose discourse. I think what that sutra is a short discourse in prose by the Buddha himself, not by disciples, and given in a declarative form. So that means that a sutta is a text where the Buddha sits down and he says, monks, here are these 4 satipatthanas. What for? One contemplates the body as a body, contemplates feeling as feelings, contemplates mind as mind, contemplates dhammas as dhammas. This is the 4 satipatthanas. Okay? That's a sutta. That's what I would say is a sutta in this sense here that's meant in the Angas.
Rather than those that are questions have been asked of.
Yeah.
So it's just when he sits down and starts talking rather than being asked questions.
We'll talk about that. Yeah, get that in a minute.
Is this what this one is?
Yeah, that's right. Well, we'll get to the question answer in a minute. Okay. Yeah. The Gaya. Yeah. Sutta in Pali, Sutra in Sanskrit. Yeah. Gaya. That's the next one. Gaya literally means song. And mixed prose and verse discourses, and both the northern and the southern traditions say that Gaya means primarily the collection that we now have in the first part of the Samyutta Nikaya, which is called the Sagatavaga, the chapter with verses. So the first section, first of five sections in the Samyutta Nikaya, is the Gaya section. Okay. Third section we call Vyakarana. Again, explanation analysis doesn't really capture the meaning of it precisely enough. After all, this is Wikipedia. So, so, okay, prose discourse. Especially short declarative discourses. That's better, thank you. Okay, Gaya, mixed prose and verse identified with the Sagatavaga of the Samyutta Nikaya. Okay, Vyakarana explanation and analysis, but actually means answer. Okay. Discourse is in question and answer form. Okay. So discourse is in question and answer format. Gatha is verse. Udana, inspired speech. So what an Udana is, we have a book called Udana now, but the idea is that you have like a bit of a narrative and a bit of a background and so on, and at the end of it you have what they call an inspired utterance, which is usually in verse, sometimes in prose as well, which sort of summarises the meaning of what was said. Iti Vuttaka, beginning with thus has a Bhagavan said, that's... Iti Vuttaka is a dubious category. This is the Sanskrit version, Iti Yukta. I'll just say, go back to the Iti Yukta is the Sanskrit pronunciation. In Pali is Iti Vuttaka. I think Iti Vuttaka probably means legendary and mythological discourses. Okay, discourses which are about, say, when the Buddha taught about the, like in the Aganya Sutta, Chakravarti Sihanada Sutta, the Buddha's teaching about the evolution of society and these kinds of things. He's giving stories of things, thus it was said in the past. This is what Iti Vuttaka means, thus it was said. It's similar, they have a tradition called Itihasa, it's the same meaning, thus was said. So it's like a passing down of tradition, like tales of the past.
So the wheel-turning monarch story.
Those kinds of things, yeah. That's what I think Iti Vuttaka actually means. Jataka, the story of previous life, usually, of course, especially the Buddha's previous lives. Adbhuta Dharma, concerning wonders and miraculous events. Yeah, again, that's not 100% accurate, that it's true, but it's more characteristically in Buddhism to do with the wonderful and marvellous qualities of the Buddha himself, usually. Okay, so, or the other monks. For example, there's sutta on the wonderful and marvellous qualities of Venerable Ananda.
Fantastic. The Jataka actually attributed to the Buddha is Buddhavacca.
There are some Jatakas which are taught in the actual Nikayas.
Oh, okay. Yeah. But the ones which are outside of the...
No, they're not attributed to them.
So is that clear when it says Jataka? Is it really clear that it's distinguishing between what is sutra and what is...
Can we talk about that a bit later? Yeah, just going through the meaning of these things at the moment, yeah? Vaipulya, either extended discourses or those giving joy, CF Mahayana texts, that's not a particularly good thing, good analysis. It's called Vaipulya in the Sanskrit sources, which is a word for Mahayana sutras in Sanskrit, Vaipulya meaning long. Right? So of course Mahayana sutras are very long, so it becomes a word for the Mahayana sutras. But the original derivation, the original or earlier word is not Vaipulya but Vedala, which is a cartoon. That's a cartoon, excuse me. Okay, Vedala, and what does Vedala mean? Oh, that's right, yeah, Vedala is an obscure term which is not very well understood, but the best explanation for it is actually given by a Sangha, and he derives it from a root, I think the root is dal, if I remember rightly. Anyway, it's a fairly obscure root, and then it becomes weird dal, and this is the thing. Basic idea here is that the root meaning is to break or split, so that where dala is similar to what we mentioned yesterday in talking about vibhanga. So vibhanga is an analysis, a splitting up, so a discourse which is analytical, which breaks things up. Okay, so that's what I think this category where dala means. I don't think it's got anything to do with Mahayana. I think that's a later interpretation of that. Nidana. So this is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. So that's the first 9. So these are the 9 that are found in the Pali texts and also found in the Mahasangika texts. The 12 are found in the Sarvasivadin and I think also in the Dharmaguptaka texts, with these last 3 added. Nidana. Very hard to say what Nidana actually means. Nidana means source. And usually is used for a text which gives the origin of something. So, for example, the background story to the founding of the Vinaya is called a Nidana. Perhaps that's what the Nidana originally meant. That's what I suspect that it maybe meant, was actually the life story of the Buddha. That's what I suspect is the original meaning of Nidana. Avadana. Avadana is like the Jatakas, except it's usually the Jatakas from the previous life stories of the other bhikkhus and bhikkhunis rather than that of the Buddha. Upadesha means instructions. And again, not 100% sure what that means. It's often understood as being Abhidhamma. But whether that's the case or not. So this scheme of angas is a list of the teachings of the Buddha, which is found repeatedly within the early Buddhist texts themselves. All right. So this list is not an invention of the later tradition. It's something which is found repeatedly in the texts, and we can only assume that it was the earliest form in which the Buddhist scriptures were collected and gathered and analysed. Okay. Now. Later on, of course, the scriptures were reorganized. And it seems that the later tradition lost its understanding, really, of what these angas were. Right? So that in the later tradition, the explanations of these angas is sometimes unclear, it's sometimes implausible, it's sometimes contradictory. I mean, some of them are fairly straightforward, but a lot of them are not very well understood. And again, while that might seem a bit confusing, but it's actually quite reassuring, you know, in a sense that it's also a sign that it's actually very early if something it's been lost, the understanding of it's been lost so quickly. Now, in History of Mindfulness, I developed my own theory about these things, which was based on some statements by Asanga, the great Yogacara commentator, and taken up by Master Yin Shun, the modern Taiwanese scholar. And Yin Shun suggested that the original or the earliest form of these groups was actually just the first three, Sutta, Gaya, and Vyakarana. There's actually one text found in the Pali and in Chinese version which actually only mentions the first three, Sutta, Gaya, and Vyakarana. And Asanga seems to identify these three more or less with what we have today as the Samyutta Nikaya. So if we look into the Samyutta Nikaya, we see the first section of it is the Gaya, is the mixed prose and verse discourses. And if we look at the large prose sections, right, we have a big section on the khandhas, a big section on the sense bases, big section on dependent origination, and big sections on all the categories of the path, the Noble Eightfold Path, the five spiritual faculties, all of these things. And within each of these collections, we see a distinction between very simple, straightforward discourses, and the Buddha saying these five khandhas are impermanent, you should contemplate them as impermanent. One who contemplates as impermanent lets go of them and is able to find freedom from them. That's what the Buddha said. Yeah? And so this is, I would say, is a sutra. And that's the basic meaning of what a sutra means in the Indian environment. A sutra is a short, pithy statement on a core doctrinal topic. But we also find plenty of places where people are coming up to the Buddha, monks, nuns, and so on, or else disciples are sitting amongst themselves and they're discussing the teachings. What do you mean when you say these things are impermanent? Okay? How does this bit relate to that bit? What's the meaning of that statement? And so this is what I would say is the Vyakarana. And so what I noticed when I was researching this is that even today, even though they're not explicitly organized in this format, but still you tend to find all the sutra ones clumped together in the same bits. We'll find a bunch of sutras, in another bit we'll find a bunch of Vyakaranas. So they're actually organized in terms of this division between the declarative and the interrogative discourses. It's most apparent if you want to have a look at it in the Pali, in the Samayatanavagga, on the six sense bases, where the first 50 discourses are almost all just declarative discourses, straightforward. The eye is impermanent, the ear is impermanent, and so on. And then from the 51st one, or more or less the 51st one, a bhikkhu came to the Buddha and he asked, how is this? How are the six sense bases impermanent? So we go into the question and answer. So this is my feeling, is that this was a fundamental early distinction between the declarative and the interrogative questions. And you can see with the interrogative questions that you're starting to move in that direction towards the kind of the evolution away from the, if you like, the pure Buddha's voice. You don't just have the Buddha's voice anymore. You have the Buddha's voice and disciples' voices. Yeah? You maybe even have discussions by the disciples among themselves. So you're starting, it's the start of that process away from the scriptures being just the pure statements of the Buddha. Okay? So this is my feeling, is that the earliest canonical collection was essentially that. Okay? Those three angas. It doesn't mean to say that was all that was there, but it's the first part that was selected and comprised as being the core doctrinal collection. Right? Now, then we have these sections here which don't quite fit into that scheme, and where have they ended up? Well, if we look at the existing Buddhist canon, you see, most of the time we have a book books that correspond with these things. So, for example, the Gatha, we have like the Theragatha, the Therigatha, the verses of the elder bhikkhus and elder nuns. So that would be an example of the Gatha in a particular section. Okay, so it's not just a random thing, but there's an actual book called a gatha. Similarly, Udana, we have a book in the Pali canon called Udana. No, actually, the Udana is actually very similar class of literature to the Dhammapada literature. Okay, so you're probably all familiar with Dhammapada. Actually, the boundaries between those, the Udana and the Dhammapada, are very fluid. And similar texts will be called Dhammapada in one version and Udana in another. So the Udana probably includes those things, including the Dhammapada. The difference in the Pali, of course, is that in the Udana, we have the prose background and the verse, the actual inspired Udana. In the Dhammapada, we just have the verse. We don't have the prose background. So what's happened in Pali is that the verses and the background were frozen in the Udana at quite an early stage, yeah? Whereas a bunch of other verses were passed down in the tradition, told with a background. Okay, so these verses would always have a background, but the backgrounds remained more fluid and more open in the tradition, and that was later codified in the Dhammapada commentary. Okay. Itivuttaka, again, we have a book called the Itivuttaka. Jataka, the Jataka books in Pali, there's 520 Jataka stories. But this is showing the complexity of the issue, because there's also in the canonical, the main four Nikayas, we also have Jataka stories where the Buddha said, this is the story of my past life, and then he told the story. Okay, so that was like the kernel of the Jataka stories, and then afterwards many of the folk tales and various kinds of things get incorporated and into the Jataka collection. Many Jatakas as well as in the Pali, and hundreds of Jatakas in the northern collections as well. A Buddha Dhamma, in the Pali there's no, there's a few suttas in this category, there's no book in that category. Same with Vedala, there's just a few suttas called Vedala. Nidana, Avadana, Nidana, again possibly the Buddha's life story. Avadana, there's a book called Avadana in the Pali. Upadesha, there's no book called Upadesha in Pali. So most of these books, in this tale, if you like, of the thing, in the Pali are found within the what we call the Kuddaka Nikaya. Okay? So again, my theory or my suggestion is that these first three categories correspond roughly with what we have as the four Nikayas in Pali, and then these ones correspond roughly with the fifth Nikaya. There's very loose correspondence there. Okay? Usually the Buddhists, yeah. Okay, so this is the probably the earliest form that the scriptures were put into. Now, we don't have them in that form today. Why not? Well, nobody knows. It's interesting that in the commentary to the first council, it says that when Mahakasapa was selecting the monks to attend the first council, he rejected all of those monks who were fluent in the Angas, in the nine Angas, and only accepted those who were fluent in the five Nikayas. So that's quite interesting, isn't it? So this suggests that the councils were one of the nexus, or the juncture point, which moved from using the Anga system to using the Nikaya system. And again, we can only speculate as to why that change was made. But again, my feeling is that if we look at the way that the Nikayas are structured and we look at how the tradition treats them, we find that each of the Nikayas, which is mentioned here, is said to have been passed down by a particular group of reciters. Okay? So you have the reciters of the Diga Nikaya, the reciters of the Majjhima Nikaya, the reciters of Tsangyutta Nikaya. And they were obviously to a certain degree independent. And we know that because sometimes the commentary records differences of opinion among them. Right? So for example, we have anapana. Right? Anapana, in-breathing and out-breathing, and according to the Majjhima reciters, ana is the in-breathing and pana is the out-breathing, and according to the Digha reciters, ana is the out-breathing and pana is the in-breathing. Okay? Or the other way around, something like that. So there's these minor differences in opinion between the different reciters. So they obviously may be residing in different monasteries with different teachers, and they would specialise in each one. So I think that the Nikaya system was set up, possibly in the councils or sometime soon afterwards, as a system to make it the reciting and the memorization of the text more methodical. So it was basically to try to preserve the text by breaking them up into more or less equally sized groups, so that each Nikaya was kind of enough to learn for one, usually for one monk or one nun in their lifetime. And because that was a more efficient organization system, the old system of the Angas gradually faded away. Okay? So this is my understanding of that. Okay, now so what have we got? So when we look at the suttas these days, then they're collected in terms of what we call the four Nikayas in Pali, or we call the four Agamas in Chinese. Oh, that's not Chinese, usually in Sanskrit. Actually, the Pali tradition uses the word Agama as well, but typically we call them the Nikayas these days. Nikaya just means collection. Agama means what has been passed down, what has come down. Okay, so it means something like a tradition, what has come down through the tradition. So the long first sequence that we have in Pali, the Digha Nikaya, contains 34 texts, including Mahaparinibbana Sutta, Brahmajala Sutta, Dirghagama of the Dharmaguptaka also survives in Chinese. It contains 30 sutras, and in addition to that, there's most of a Sarvastivadin Dirghagama has been recently discovered in Sanskrit. So we have more or less two and a half Digas in existence. The Sanskrit one hasn't been published yet. It's in the hands of the Germans. They'll do a great job, but they're not going to hold our breath for the outcome of it. Okay, so this is the Digha. Sometimes the Digha is said to have the particular focus of being useful for converting Brahmins. Okay, so it has a lot of texts which deal with Brahmanical issues, dialogues with Brahmins, refutations of Brahmanical teachings and things like that.
So is it also that 32 marks comes into a great extent, don't they?
It is in the Pali, although interestingly enough not in the Chinese. In the Chinese the equivalent suttas in the Majjhima. But it is mentioned, the 32 marks are mentioned in quite a lot of suttas in the Digha, that's quite true as well. Okay. I don't know if we'll get into all the details of the 32 marks right away. But anyway, that's the higher teachings. Long discourses, then the medium length discourses, Majjhima Nikaya, or Madhyama Agama, Zhonga Han Qing in Chinese. The rest of suttas of any length, that's not particularly good English, but anyway, medium length, usually a better way of putting it. The Pali Majjhima Nikaya has 152 suttas. Madhyama Agama of Sarvastivada contains 222 suttas. Okay, so in Chinese translation.
so that it's depending on each tradition as to where they place particular suttas. Some
right.
place one in the Vinaya, where in the Pali they become the Majjhima or the Samyutta. They change it around according to how they want to organize things.
Yeah, I mean, it's somewhat curious because they all have the same organizational system. Yeah. So, or every school, as far as we know, had the same organizational system. Yet it seems to have been quite independent. Like, how do you choose to implement that? You know, the same basic thing, but quite different. I mean, the difference between 152 suttas and 222 suttas is quite a major difference. Of course, of those 222 suttas, most of them are found elsewhere in the Pali Canon. There's a few that are not. I think there's about 12 suttas altogether that are not shared in common, something like that. So most of them are found. But yeah, it's quite free in terms of how they were placed. Okay, next one, connected discourses, Sanghita Nikaya. This grouping consists of many short texts connected by theme, setting, or interlocutor. Interlocutor meaning what? Okay, very good. Interlocutor. Okay. The person the Buddha was talking to. Yeah. So for example, you have like the Vachagata Sanyutta, where Vachagata comes to the Buddha and asks a series of questions. As I mentioned before, the main list of topics in the Sanyutta is very important. I call it the Sanyutta Matika, and it consists of the essential list of doctrinal topics which is found all through Buddhism, every school of Buddhism, constantly through the Abhidhamma, constantly through the Mahayana Sutras. It's like the backbone of things like, say, the Heart Sutra and many other places. So that list is of the five aggregates, six sense bases, the elements, dependent origination, the Four Noble Truths, and the various factors of the path, the Eightfold Path, what we call the 37 Bodhipakyadhammas, the Eightfold Path, seven awakening factors, five spiritual faculties, five spiritual powers, four Iddhipadas, basis of spiritual power, basis of psychic power, four Satipatthanas, and the four right efforts. So that list of topics is the main headings, the main sections within the Sanyutta Nikaya. Okay, and I think we can make a very good case to say that group of topics was the essential main group of themes that the Buddha spoke about. So the Sanyutta Agama of Sarvastivada in Chinese translation contains only 1300 suttas. Actually, the difference between the numbers is quite arbitrary, because within the Sanyutta you find very often that we were just reading one earlier today with Shirley, and there was, you know, it goes through the sutta, and then it says at the end of it, it discusses these five aggregates are impermanent, form is impermanent, you should let go of it, feeling is impermanent, you should let go of it, and so on. And it literally says, and so on, right? And then it gets to the end of it, and then it says, as for impermanence, the same for suffering, for emptiness, and for not-self. Okay? So how do you then count that? If you want, you can count that as four suttas, right? Each one sutta dealing with one characteristic. Or you could count it as one sutta with all four put together. And that is a very common feature in the Sanghita Nikaya, where a sutta in one place in the Pali may be counted as one sutta, in the Chinese may be counted as four suttas or something. You can even have it in one sutta in one place and ten in another. For example, like the five sense bases. You might go through the five sense bases, yeah, and internal and external. And they're all in one sutta in the Pali, and then they become ten suttas in the Chinese, or vice versa. So constantly finding this throughout the Sanghita Nikaya and Sanghita Agama. So the actual number of suttas is a bit arbitrary, really. As well as the Sanghita Agama, this is Taisho 99, referred to here, the complete one. There's also two partial Sanghita Agamas in the Chinese translation, which only contain a short section of that. I'll have a look at that a bit later. And in addition to that, there are some materials from Sanskrit manuscripts that have been found with Sanyutta Agama type texts. Next one, numbered discourses. Sutras which have the same number of doctrinal items, i.e. the group of the ones, the group of the twos, there are these two things. What two? Nama and Rupa. Or whatever they are. So groups of two things and so on. 2,300 suttas in Pali. Chinese canon contains Ekotara Agama, so an equivalent, it's misspelled there, which is thought by some scholars to belong to the Mahasanghika school. Originally, it's a bit good English. Okay. Okay. So this is the Anguttara Nikaya. Again, in Chinese, we have another smaller partial Anguttara. Now, the interesting thing about the Anguttara is that this text, the Ekotara Agama, is actually very different from the Pali Anguttara Nikaya. Whereas the other ones are relatively similar, these two are actually very, very different. And the Ekotara Agama is one of the most frustrating texts in Buddhism. The translation is abysmal. It's doctrinally full of bizarre inconsistencies, like it'll have two different versions of the Noble Eightfold Path within the same sutra. I mean, this is quite extraordinary. I mean, the Eightfold Path is consistently presented through thousands of suttas and all the schools and all the time and everything. You know, there's no inconsistency in how it's presented. And yet in the Ekotara Agama, you'll find it presented inconsistently in the same sutta, right? So who were these guys, you know? A bunch of hippies, if you ask me. possibly, yeah. So, and thought by some scholars to belong to the Mahasanghika school. Very difficult to know for exactly that reason, that you can't identify any doctrinal consistency within there that would enable you to identify the school. So the school is really unknown. It's really just a best guess, is to say maybe associated with Mahasanghika somehow. Okay. And the miscellaneous texts, the Kuddaka Nikaya, not all schools have this category. But the Pali Kuddaka Nikaya had several well-known and loved texts. It seems that all the schools probably would have had a group of similar kind of texts, but they wouldn't necessarily call it the Kuddaka Nikaya or Kshudraka Agama in Sanskrit. Dhammapada, this is just, unfortunately it's not a complete list, but this is just some of them. Dhammapada, Udana, Suttanipata, so this is a Gatha, Teragatha and Terigatha, Jataka. So, as I said before, this one's connected with the later versions of the parts of the Agamas. Sorry, of the Angas. Sorry, this needs editing again. Sorry, parts of the Suttanipata. That's a bit inaccurate. No.
Because I was fixing it.
Okay. Didn't say properly.
It's Sometimes it doesn't appear because it needs to be
refreshed.
Sometimes.
Maybe refresh. Also, is there anything else in there? Refresh the page, maybe needs to refresh. Perhaps there's a certain Nikata, maybe. Atikavada Prayanavaga, a thought by some scholars to represent the earliest strata of the written canon.
It's a citation needed.
I'm going to say Sujata still. Right, okay. And so, Jataka, many of these texts are available in translation as well as the original language. The Dhammapada, for instance, has a Pali version, three Chinese versions, a Tibetan version, and a Khotanese version. Khotanese, what about Gandhari?
My friends specialise in Khotanese.
Khotanese, what about the Gandhari?
Where's Khotanese?
Khotan? Where's Khotan?
It's in middle of the... where is it? Yeah.
Central Asia.
Central Asia. What's it called? Maybe
Kazakhstan or something.
Yeah, something like that.
Kazakhstan or one of the stands.
I can find out. You can find out. I mean, so if you want the Khotanese text, let me know.
Right. Oh, that's good. Do you want to know where Khotan is? These missions aligned to the east of the
Kashgar. It was destroyed by Muslim invaders.
Position of Buddhism in Khotan. Khotanese tribute and trade missions to Han China were mostly accompanied by Buddhist monks. States often engage monks for diplomatic purposes. But it's Khotan at this time, so it's around. Is Uyghur. How does anyone know how to pronounce Uyghur?
Yes.
Gansu, Uyghur, Mongolia, which
are. Tans?
Okay. Okay. Ah, Khotan down here, yeah. Okay, you
go. Way up north of Lavinia.
Is that a city or a country?
I guess it would have been a city and it would have had its own region. Yes, the Silk Road. So, is that okay, Annie?
on Wikipedia,
Alright, so there we have Khotan in the early Buddhist texts.
So, not speak, but manage to study the language.
Alright, so that's a survey of the sutra literature. Does anyone have any questions on that particular bit before we go on? I should probably mention that when we have the, of course, the Pali texts are, of course, in the Pali language. The other texts, the texts in Chinese translation, would have been originally in different Indian languages. The Dirga Agama of the Dharmaguptaka was probably in a language they call Gandhari. Sarvasivadam literature for the Madhyama and the Samyutta would have been in Sanskrit. The Mahasangika, Ekotra Agama, if it was Mahasangika text, would have been in Buddhist hybrid Sanskrit. So they were translated from different Indian dialects by different, usually the translators would have been monks. Often they were Indian monks or even from Central Asia who'd learnt the languages and then came to China. Sometimes Chinese monks who'd been to India and learnt the Indian languages there and then came back and so on. So they were mostly translated around 400 AD. Okay.
In the Buddha's time, writing was available?
In the Buddha's time, writing was available, but it wasn't used for religious texts. Yeah, it was used. Probably was used for. Originally, would have been used for royal decrees,
mm-hmm.
and for trade,
mm-hmm.
rather than religious texts.
So they would use any sort of text for anything?
No, it doesn't seem so. Look, they may well have written down bits and pieces,
yeah.
which we don't really know about. There's an intriguing passage in the commentary where it talks about a gift given by King Bimbisara
mm-hmm.
to another king, where he actually had large sections of the canon inscribed on gold plates.
Mm-hmm.
And that's actually a very plausible, and then sent as part of a trade mission.
Mm-hmm.
It's actually a very plausible scenario because we know the writing was used by the kings, we know it was used as part of trade,
mm-hmm.
and gold was very plentiful in ancient India
mm-hmm.
before the British nicked it all. And the gold is an excellent writing material because
mm-hmm.
yeah, it's very soft. So it's actually not at all implausible that that happened. So it'd be fascinating if they were to dig up a stupa or something like that and find gold plates in there. Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
There are some ancient copper plates about 1500 years old, but I haven't found any ancient. Yeah, so here's just a summary of the Agamas in Chinese translation, and you can have a look at this in more detail on Wikipedia if you like. But the this has the translation dates. Sanyutta Agama translated by Gunabhadra, about 435 to 443 CE. Okay. Madhyama Agama, Dzongkha Hanjing, translated by Sanghadeva in 397 to 398 CE. Dirga Agama, translated by Buddha Yashas and Zhu Fonian in the late Qing dynasty, 413 CE. Ekota Agama, translated by Dharmanandi and finished by Sanghadeva, is thought to be either from, I think Dharmanandi might have died before he finished it or something, or given it up or something. Either Mahasanghika or Sarvasti Vardhan canons. Okay? I've never heard a serious argument to say it's from Sarvasti Vardhan. I think they just made that bit up. Yeah, I mean, Kyaun, I don't know what he's based that on.
The Dictionary of Buddhism, Oxford University Press.
Wouldn't worry about that too much. Oh, there's my friend Ananda Jyoti. There you go. These are my monk I met in Taiping.
English translations?
There's some
that are the Ekota which we have.
Yeah, the. Okay, so.
Well, and that's just how we do people now.
Mm hmm. Okay, so just before we do this, I find it's quite interesting that all of these agamas were translated within basically one generation. The earliest date we have here is 397 and the latest date 443. So it's just a short period of time in ancient China, it seems, when these things were brought over and translated.
They did have a culture though of heavy scholarly based work in Indian China.
Of course, yeah.
So they had about maybe 100 scribes working on them.
Of course, a little bit given.
There would have been a group of people. Like when that's a good point actually. When they listed the translators there, you know, we shouldn't think of it like a translator today.
Mm.
Typically what they would do is somebody would read it out. So somebody would read out the text in the Indic language and then somebody would translate it from Indic into Chinese, and then somebody would write it down. So there'd be a team of people working, so that the name of the translator there would be more or less the leader of the translation team, rather than somebody just doing it by himself. Yeah. So maybe a number of scribes and people helping out there. But the Agama translations are not like really good translations. As time went on in China, the expertise in doing translation became much greater. Actually, the golden period of translations was a bit later than that. And so Kumarajiva and then later Xuanzang and so on, and they did very beautiful translations which became very authoritative in the Chinese tradition. The Agama translations are not so... not so reliable, not so faithful, and not such good language. Anyway, here's some translations from the Ekotara Agama, and this is a website I've been working on for ages. I haven't got it finished yet. I still want someone to type them up. If anyone wants to type up the rest of the Ekotara Agama Suttas, please volunteer. Lions and sheep.
Yes. Mm-hmm. The running flying fox thing.
Okay.
So this is translated from Chinese into English.
Translated from Chinese into English by a monk called Bhikkhu Pasadika, together with some people in Europe, Timori and Sarah Boyne.
Yeah,
just
copy.
Yeah.
Translations
appeared in the Buddhist Studies Review over a period of about a decade.
So that's hard copy.
That's hard copy, yeah.
Just talk
to yeah. So that's yeah, that's literally what Ekotara means, yeah. So very few translations of Agama Sutras into English. Of course, the four Nikayas, we have generally very good translations. We have the Digha by Maurice Walsh, which is a reasonable translation, excellent translations of the Majjhima and Samyutta, and now the Anguttara Nikaya, Bhikkhu Bodhi is finishing off. Most of the Kudika has also been translated. Whereas with the Agamas, we have very, very few. It's quite, I think, quite a scandal in Buddhism that there is not a single translation of a complete Agama into English. I think this is appalling. And nor is there a complete translation of an early Vinaya into English, from apart from the Pali.
When you're talking, sorry, what, when you're saying Chinese, don't they, a particular school or any school?
Anything. There's no translation from any... No Agama has been translated into English from Chinese. There's a few suttas here and there have been translated, but no complete Agama. They're working now on the Madhyama Agama, but again, it's just a group of my mates, basically. It's Analio and Rod Bucknell and Marcus Bingenheimer, and it's a very small circle of scholars who are working on these things, and they're now working to translate the Majjhima Agama. But it's a scandal.
So you can't do a comparative study of all, really, on this.
This is in Chinese.
Yeah.
So this is Sutta Central. And Sutta Central is very cool. And Sutta Central is a database, online database, set up by myself and some Rod Bucknell and Venerable Mario, John Kelly, who was here last year, and Ong Yong Peng in Brisbane. And we wanted to provide a place that would coordinate the facilities for the different languages, Buddhist texts in different languages. So that's what we've done. And so what this does here, we have the Digha Nikaya, Majjhima Nikaya, Sanyutta Nikaya, Anguttara Nikaya, Kudha Nikaya, Vinaya and Abhidhamma. These are, the last three are under construction. These guys are more or less finished. So if we have a look at the Digha, for example, we have the list down here of all the suttas in the Digha Nikaya. Each sutta, the title, volume page number in the Pali Text Society edition. The corresponding suttas and the translations into English, German, and Spanish. So here's the correspondences. So this gives us the Brahmajala Sutta. We mentioned earlier that this is the sort of the 62 views of the Brahmajala. And this being the list of all the corresponding suttas. Now, what do we mean when we say a corresponding sutta? When we say a corresponding sutta, what we mean is that we think that this sutta probably derived from the same original source. Okay, so that's what a corresponding sutta means. It means that it seems that likely that it actually was the original oral teaching of the Buddha, and we have it now in these different versions. So two Chinese versions, also, and one, and then two partial. This has an asterisk, which means a partial parallel. Okay, that means that, well, it's kind of similar, but not really the same. But if you want to really look at it in detail, you probably want to have a look at that one. That's what partial parallel means. Okay, so we had quite a lot of debate about how to classify these things, and that's about the best we could come up with. Then various Sanskrit fragments published. Here's all the publication details for the Sanskrit blah blah.
What is this title we find at the top left hand up here?
Not derived from it, but corresponding to it. The only reason the Digha Nikaya is up here is because I went through the Pali, so I can go through the Chinese. I'll do that again and show it from the Pali. But it's not trying to suggest that the Digha is more basic than the others. Yeah, they're just corresponding. And then Tibetan version, and two Tibetan versions. This is probably the same one in a different edition. Sanskrit fragments. Okay, so then if we have a look at all the things we've come, here's the Brahmajala Sutta, here's the English, blah blah blah. Digha Nikaya, German version, Spanish version, and Posca Theravada. And here's Chinese text. So this is from the online version of the Taisho Canon. These are the reference numbers in the Taisho edition. So in the Chinese Buddhist canon is the most widely used academic edition of it is called the Taisho. We call the Taisho Tripitaka, and that was published by the Japanese Taisho University in the 1920s. And that was the first time that it had been published according to Western kind of modern scholarly conventions, so that the Japanese scholars who did that had actually been to Germany and studied under Max Müller in Germany. So if you'd like to think of it in terms of political conspiracies, the Japanese and the Germans working together to produce in the 1920s, the authoritative Buddhist text. I won't go into the political implications of this, but anyway... Taisho, this is a volume number, so it's the first book. This is the sutra number. So each in the Taisho, each distinct text is called a sutra. Yeah, if you can go on. It's called a sutra. No matter whether it's a vinaya or an abhidhamma or whatever, it's just a sort of sutra number, and it's a page number, and column number, and the line number. So that's just the reference. So each line has its own reference number. This is one of the Chinese versions. Another one of the Chinese versions. So this is on the Sibeta Tripitaka, put together by Venerable, or founded originally by Venerable Hong Ching, the Taiwanese bhikkhu.
Do we have an English equivalency on this content?
Of what?
Where the Taisho is displayed in this way on the Sibetas?
No. The best we have, line by line, we don't have a line by line thing. The best we have is probably this one online, which is the most recent. This is the most up to date Pali website, and so this, thank you very much, doesn't give line by line numbering, but gives paragraph numbering and things like that.
So the super central is like
Exactly, yeah. So it's called Sutta Central. It's basically a database of links, a database of references and links. Wherever we can find things on the web, we link up to it. So every Sanskrit text we can find, we put to it. Whatever translations we find, we can put to it. It doesn't have everything, but as many as we can. This is the partial canon, 1, 2, 1. So again, this is what was done in Japan. So volume 1 contains the Digha and the Majjhima. So that's the Digha Agama and the Majjhima Agama. And the sequence of it, it goes Digha, Majjhima, Samyutta, Ekotara in these two books, right? So that's the four Agamas, which is the same sequence as in Pali. Digha, Majjhima, Samyutta, Ekotara, Anguttara in Pali. And of course that was the reason they did it like that was because they'd already studied with Max Müller and they'd studied the Pali canon. Yeah? So it's very interesting to notice that even in the 20th century, right, that the Chinese Tripitaka, in its structure, has been influenced by the Pali canon. Yeah? Previous editions, it wasn't like that. Previous editions, the agamas would be various places inside the canon. But they were taken out, they put at the start of the canon, and ordered in the same sequence as the Pali by the Japanese editors. That's right.
That's the 100 book set.
The other ones are okay, Chinese canon, blah blah blah. Here's the table. So this is a very reliable table.
Which is made by you?
Made by me. I didn't make it, I just put it in there. So, see 1 and 2, the Agama Sutras. 2, 3, and 4 is the Jatakas. 5 to 8, Paramita. 9, Saddhamma, the Lotus Sutra. 9 to 10, Avatamsaka Sutra. 11 to 12, Ratnakuta. It's a collection of Mahayana Sutras. Tasha 12, the Mahayana Parinirvana Sutra, Sannipata Sutra, Sutra Sannipata, it's collections of sutras and so on. No. It's a similar title, but not the same text. Tantra text, T18 to 21, Tantra 22 to 24 is the Vinaya text, 25 to 26, Sutra Vyakarana, so explanations of the sutras. Abhidharma texts, 26 to 29. So the Abhidharma are mostly the Sarvastivadin Abhidharma, with some also Dharmaguptaka Abhidharma. Madhyamaka, Yogacara school. Yoga isn't like stretching and stuff, it's the Yogacara texts. Shastras, Sutra Vibhasha, Vinaya Vibhasha, and so on. So the later is the various kind of commentaries and so on, and then later on still histories, collected matters, non-Buddhist teachings, catalogues. So there's whole books full of catalogues, ancient and doubtful.
The non-Buddhist
teachings one I think is quite interesting. I think they have got things like Nestorian Christian texts and stuff like that in there. Yeah. But I don't know if anyone reads them. It does, yeah. That is the canon. Yeah, it includes everything. They took a very inclusive attitude towards their texts, whereas the Pali, of course, has a similar sort of span of literature, but they kept a much more clear distinction between the canon and then the commentaries and things. Whereas the Chinese, the tendency was to include everything.
So when is it again you said that there was a switch from the Angus to the Agamas, to the Kayas?
Yeah.
When is it the first council?
First council is straight after the Buddha is there.
So, I don't know, how is it in the Pali the order is decided? I mean, I know there's books and, like, where is it said that the order is?
The order is given differently in the different accounts of the First Council. So each school, when it's telling the story of the First Council, says that its own canon was recited at the First Council. Right? So the Pali says it was the Diga first and started with the Brahmajala Sutta and then Samanyapala Sutta. That's unique to the Pali canon. But according to the Pali school, that's what was recited at the First Council. According to the Dharmaguptaka, of course, it was their own canon. According to Sarvastivadins, the first sutta, for example, was the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta. Mm-hmm. And so each one has backdated their account of the First Council to describe their own canon at that time.
So there wasn't any consistent order, it was just...
It doesn't seem to have been, no. Yeah. Yeah, again, there's always in Buddhist literature a curious mix of certain things which are very consistent. You know, like there are four Nikayas, four Agamas every school, but what order are they in is very inconsistent.
You
know? Yeah. So it's this curious mixture of things. Anyway, so this is the Chinese canon, and of course there being a Tibetan canon as well. We don't need to go there. All right. How are we going for time? So, so just to answer any question before, for example, if I decided from here to look into the Chinese texts, then I have the main Chinese ones here. Let's choose the Akotara Agama just for the sake of it. I have the Chinese ones here. Oh, actually, it's probably not very good because there's probably not many correspondences. Oh, yeah, here we go. Let's have some. So here we have the Chinese ones here, the corresponding suttas here. So this Chinese EA 8.2 corresponds with this Anguttara Nikaya text. Okay, or if we come back here, we go into the Samyutta. And here's all the Samyutta texts. And again, notice down here the list of translations. And, oh, there we go. Translation done by a student of Rod Bucknell, Chong Moon Keat. So again, there's a very small circle of people doing these things. So here's the translation.
Some of you, Shelley.
Why is there an ad block? It's supposed to have an ad block. Well, it is paying for Wikipedia to survive, so I guess it's all right. So,
the fashion store.
So that's quite meaningful. So this is from Marcus, yeah. Oh, that's good. That's there. This is not the website that you're looking for. Marcus in Okay. So this is done by a fellow called Marcus Bingenheimer, who's a German scholar who's working at the Dharma Drum Mountain in Taiwan. And he's doing a translation of the... So, now this is a pure coincidence, all right? Of the Beta Ahan Jing is the shorter Sangyukta Agama in Chinese. So it's T100. The full one is T99, and so this is the partial one. So it just happens to be. And so he's done a great job. If anyone's interested, have a look at this. I think this first sutra particularly is well worth
reading.
Vasava heard once the Buddha stayed at the mango grove in the country of Mithila. At this time, Venerable Sujata had just gone forth and cut off his head. He came to the Buddha, paid homage by touching the Buddha's feet, and sat down at one side. The Buddha told the other monks, "This son of a good family, Sujata, is splendid in two ways. First, his appearance is of extraordinary beauty, his features exceptionally handsome. Secondly, he cut off his hair and covered his body with a robe. Feeling deeply that family life was all too ephemeral, he went forth and pursued the way. He ended all afflictions, is filled with purity, has liberated his mind from desire, has liberated his wisdom from ignorance. In his very body he has attained the unconditioned, forever ended the cycle of life and death. Established in the pure life, he will not have to endure another existence." And then the translation of the verse. "Monk, always calm and concentrated, abandons desire and life and death, abides in his final body. He can defeat Mara's armies, training his mind. He breaks all fetters. His uprightness is without equal." So that's pretty good, isn't it? And what? And what Marcus has done here is gives you three columns, and you can choose the Pali equivalent. So now he has the Pali next to it. I don't know if he has a translation of the Pali. Is that anything? So he has the translation, but if you look at the just to do a quick comparative study here, so you can just have a look. The Chinese version here says the Buddha staying in Mithila, whereas the Pali just says staying at Savatthi, so a different setting. Then Venerable Sujata came to see the Buddha. Okay, it doesn't mention that he'd just gone forth and cut off his hair. That sentence is missing. He saw the Buddha he sat down, paid respects to the Buddha's feet, and sat down to one side. Whereas in the Pali version, it says that the Buddha saw Sujata coming off in the distance. Okay, so he's not sitting down next to him. Then, when he's sitting down at one side, then the teaching here, the literal translation of the teaching, Ubhaye nevayam bhikkhave kulaputto sobhati. This monk's son of a good family is beautiful in both ways. It's literally what it says. So splendid in two ways. It's the same, exactly the same there. First, his appearance. Okay, yancha abhi rupo. He is gorgeous. attractive, delightful, and endowed with the highest beauty of appearance. Huh? Now, so that's pretty much the same. And then it says, and that goal for the sake of which the sons of good families rightly go forth from the home life into homelessness, the unexcelled full culmination of the holy life. Having realized it with his own direct knowledge, he is here and now, enters and abides in it. So it's a stock passage in Pali. So the Chinese is a bit different wording here, but there's certainly the same meaning. And then the verse here, Sobhati Vatayam Bhikkhu. This Bhikkhu is splendid, and he's upright, his mind is upright, he is detached and free of fetters. Attain Nibbana without grasping. He carries his final body and has defeated Mara with his armies. So the verse is quite similar. considering the difficulties of translating Pali verse into, or Indic verse into Chinese, then that's a pretty good job of getting the verse there. So the interesting thing you can see, just even that very short comparative study, is that, well, what's different and what's the same? Right? What's different is the setting is different. Right? The narrative details of how the event came about is different, right? But the actual teaching is exactly the same. So it's very important to remember that when we're looking at the suttas, that, of course, that makes perfect sense, that those who were reciting and passing down the scriptures, they were mainly concerned to actually get the teachings right. They didn't mind if you messed around a little bit with the things on the edges, but the core teachings were preserved very, very faithfully. And so this we find time and time again when looking at the comparative study. So, and actually also to notice that technically, you know, this first part, which is different in the two versions, is not really the sutta. Although we call everything here a sutta, actually the sutta, the Buddha's words, only start here. Okay, so it's only those bits that's the Buddha's words. Or in the Chinese, it's only these bits. That's the Buddha Vachana. These bits are not Buddha Vachana. They're just the background.
Even the English translation of the
Pali. No, unfortunate. Yeah, probably. Yeah, he has the two different Chinese versions and the Pali and the translation. So this is an ongoing project. I'm not sure if he's finished his translation or not. So 364 suttas. There's about a third of them. Looks like he hasn't done the translation down for them. Hasn't finished yet. So this is a great little resource.
What's
his name?
Marcus
Bingenheimer.
Yes. It's not a particularly memorable web address, it's unfortunate. buddhistinformatics.chibs.edu.tw/bza. Yeah, I usually just Google Marcus Bingenheimer. That's how I find it. Should book Marcus Bingenheimer. Alright. Anyway, so there's just some, this one and Sutta Central and so on, just some online resources if anyone wants to look a bit at the comparative study. So as I said, during the course of this, we'll try as best we can to keep in mind the different versions and so on. I should mention, actually, in the Taisho canon, it actually gives, as part of the footnotes, because footnotes being a Western invention, but it actually gives the reference to the Pali edition at the bottom of the page. So the Chinese canon refers back to the Pali, and in some cases it'll give the Pali equivalents, like the Pali spelling of different names and things like that. So they're given there in the footnotes of the Chinese. So, you know, you've had several generations of Chinese scholars who've grown up learning from the Taisho edition, who've all, you know, understood and taken for granted that this has a sort of a, you know, very important parallels with the Pali, and yet that knowledge is almost completely not known at all in the Pali world, where you don't find any mention of the Chinese canon or the Sanskrit canon within the Pali texts. Yeah. Okay. Yep. Yeah, that's good. Yeah. So when I met the people who were doing this website, the Pali website, it's Thai group, and I tried to convert them to the Agama doctrine, and yeah, they weren't all that receptive. So, yeah. Uh-huh. Okay. Oh. I think one one thing that's quite interesting, and maybe let's have a look at this, is that there's one interesting sutta here. Actually, I put it in my book, but this is a sutta about Mahapajapati, which is, as far as I'm aware, only found in the Akhotra Agama. Mahapajapati went to the Exalted One, bowed with the head at his feet, said to him, "I hope for a long time the Exalted One will bring the ignorant and deluded to their senses, and may his life never be endangered." "Gotami," responded the Exalted One, "such words in regard to the Tathagata are not appropriate. The Tathagata can prolong his lifespan, which will not be short, and his life will never really be in danger." And then Mahapajapati improvised the following verses. "How can one revere him who is foremost, who is unparalleled in the world? He is capable of removing all doubts. That is why these words of veneration are uttered." The Buddha in turn responded with these verses. "Reverence for the Tathagata implies this effort and steadfastness, a mind that is ever more courageous and which looks upon disciples as equals." This is quite interesting, this last one. "In reply to the Exalted One, Mahapajapati declared, 'Henceforth, the Exalted One should be revered for the Tathagata's insisting on regarding all living beings with a mind free from the discriminatory concepts of upper and lower. Among heavenly beings, the Tathagata is supreme. The Exalted One acknowledged what Mahapajapati said. She rose from her seat, bowed and left. The Exalted One said to the bhikshus, "Among my disciples, it is Mahapajapati who is foremost in respect of broad-mindedness and extensive awareness." So that's quite interesting, isn't it?
And you see, the bhikkhu needs to sit with the Buddha when he's doing this dispensation and
to
talk.
Mm.
Usually they stand to the side, don't they?
It depends on the...
I think it's very interesting that particular quality of like non-discrimination is specifically said Mahapajapati was the foremost at. And interestingly, it doesn't say that she's the foremost of the bhikkhunis. She's the foremost of all the disciples.
Mm.
Well, the very fact of its inconsistency is very intriguing and could have a number of different meanings. It's not at all implausible to say that the very fact that it wasn't standardized means that it may preserve early things which were removed from other scriptures, just as it may preserve later things which were added in. Yeah, it's probably a combination of them. Yeah. So it's very difficult. Always very difficult because the texts were compiled over such a long period. It's very difficult to generalize. You can say a collection may be earlier or later, but any one particular part of that collection, you know, it's very difficult to date that. So, I mean, in text critical studies, one of the principles is that these kinds of inconsistencies and so on. May well be a sign that there's been a historical progression. That's one explanation of them. And so within the inconsistencies, you can often find earlier and later ideas preserved. Whereas things that are standardized obviously tend to be standardized at a later time, and so the earlier thing might be eliminated.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So that's, again, just some background and so on. We'll start looking at the actual sutras next week.